1966 literally started with a bang in Ottawa when a would-be assassin attempted to blow up the House of Commons and kill a number of its members. Fortunately for Prime Minister Lester Pearson and opposition leader John Diefenbaker, when the would-be assassin attempted to set the fuse, the bomb exploded prematurely in a House of Commons washroom, killing him before he could toss it into the crowded house. The Speaker of the House and the Solicitor General describe what happened.
At approximately 2:55 this afternoon, an explosion took place in the washroom on the third floor of the House of Commons building outside the entrance to the ladies' gallery. At the request of the Sergeant-at-Arms, the RCMP, and the local city police of Ottawa have been called in to carry out an investigation, which is still continuing at the moment. There has been no positive identification to this point. One of the difficulties from the report I have received is that there is more than one identification on the person whose body was found on the scene, which has complicated matters somewhat. A short while ago, Mr. Pennell received a confirmation, and I received confirmation also that the person involved in the incident this afternoon was one Paul Joseph Chartier, and police also have given information that there were sticks of dynamite and three homemade bombs found in this person's residence in Toronto, and there's also evidence that he had been a patient in the psychiatric ward of a Toronto hospital. Perhaps the Solicitor General might add additional details that are in his own possession.
Well, I might add that so far as the RCMP are concerned, the information we have at hand would strongly indicate that there was no other person involved. Of course, the investigation has not been completed, but that's the evidence to date that we're showing. Other evidence would tend to indicate the man was emotionally disturbed. This opinion is founded on some written material that was found. The notes, the evidence they found, as I'm advised, indicate that he was emotionally disturbed and that he felt that there were injustices in the world that ought to be corrected, and they were not directed towards any one person having caused these injustices.
Bombs were falling in another place in the world, Vietnam, and anti-United States demonstrations took place in the spring of 1966 on Parliament Hill as the U.S. buildup in Vietnam continued and President Lyndon Johnson announced additional U.S. support to protect South Vietnam's independence. Speaking in Parliament, Prime Minister Pearson rejected the current fashionable and easy anti-U.S. approach and instead delivered a statesmanlike objective evaluation of U.S. aims.
May not all we agree with all the expressions of American policy and power, but they must all acknowledge that that policy has no design against the freedom or welfare of any other people. And that power, wherever it is exercised, in Vietnam or any other place, have no aggressive or imperialist purpose behind it.
The Prime Minister's position was not shared by Canadian Socialist leader of the NDP party, Tommy Douglas, who attacked External Affairs Minister Paul Martin on Canada's position with regard to Vietnam.
I disagree, first of all, on the basic assumption that wherever there are liberation fronts anywhere in the world, seeking to throw off the oppression of a military dictatorship, that Canada's support must necessarily go to the military dictatorship. This is, in essence, what Mr. Martin is arguing, that if there's a liberation front anywhere, and particularly in Asia, that he has dubbed as communist, our support must be for the military dictatorship which they're trying to overthrow.
Old statesman Paul Martin then asked the NDP leader a hard question.
It would be stretching the situation greatly to suggest that Canada, with its tradition of pacification, is always taking the side of military powers. I would like in turn to ask Mr. Douglas, and I do this respectfully because I know him and I have a lot of respect for him as a man and for his views and his interest in peace, I find it very difficult to understand why he will not join with me and with others in urging Hanoi and Peking to engage in negotiations.
The House of Commons' attention swings from one extreme to another, and from Vietnam, it became involved in a minor scandal involving a German call girl and a former Diefenbaker cabinet minister, and the possibility of a minor security risk. The story was uncovered when, for security reasons, the Prime Minister decided to ask the RCMP for any security files for the past 10 years on any member of Parliament. Progressive Conservative Fairweather righteously asked for a motion to censure the Prime Minister, as he felt this action on the Prime Minister's part was an act of political vengeance.
I moved a motion deploring the action of the government in seeking from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police a very general information of a scandalous nature about the conduct of members of Parliament. What I deplore is that no charges have been made. It was just a sort of a fishnet type of request. And as you know, a fishnet can gather in many things in its orbit when it's cast out. The Prime Minister of Canada had the Commissioner of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in his office, and he asked him whether he had in his possession any files of depicting matters of scandal or breaches of morality involving members of Parliament generally. Now, we have to be very careful that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police is not used as a political or government police force. This is a matter of very great importance to the country.
Suffering from a severe cold, the Prime Minister explained the reasons for his actions.
Well, I tried to say very clearly in the House the facts of this situation were that I asked the Commissioner of the Police, in the presence of the Secretary of the Cabinet, to give me the results of inquiries which might have been made over 10 years and which bore on the possibility of criminal elements, subversive elements, bringing pressure to bear on members of Parliament in a way that would interfere with the processes of law. I did this at this time because it was the period of Rebar. There was so much suspicion and innuendo and so much distressing development going on that I wanted to find out whether this situation went deep and whether it went far. Very fortunately and very reassuringly, the police brought me back only one report, and that was the first time I had ever heard of the Munsinger case. When I got that report, I realized it was a security matter. I considered it as such and nothing else. I gave it to the chairman of the security panel of the government. He locked it in a safe, and it remained there until it was asked for by the police. It was only a copy, by the way, of a memorandum that they already had, not a file. And that was all I did with it. And any possible reference to this matter in the House of Commons which occurred was no plot, no plan. It was spontaneous by the minister concerned, goaded beyond endurance, and I knew nothing whatever about it. I think that deals with the major points.
The motion specifically says, sir, that this was done as political vengeance.
That is quite untrue.
The Prime Minister's explanation was accepted, and the motion subsequently defeated. The House then moved on to another emotional but far more important debate, namely unification of Canada's armed forces. In typical Canadian fashion, demands were made for decisive leadership, but the minute Defense Minister Paul Hellyer demonstrated these characteristics in his unification battle, cries of arrogance immediately arose. Progressive Conservative Gordon Churchill spoke this way about Mr. Hellyer and his unification plan.
We're not getting the effective fighting machine that we require. A little more humility on the part of Mr. Hellyer would be more in keeping with the responsibilities that he has.
But the defense minister was not reluctant to hit back at his critics.
Well, this is a lot of nonsense, of course. Actually, we've accomplished a great deal. The opposition that has been put forward has been something of a buckshot or pop gun effort, but it's been irrelevant and inaccurate, very much of it. And I'm quite prepared to go before the Standing Committee on Defense and to bring expert witnesses and to go into all of the areas that have been raised and to present the facts. We can stand on the facts because they're good.
Even a minor revolt of some of the admirals wishing to maintain the status quo did not faze Paul Hellyer, because he knew history was on his side.
I think I have the great overwhelming majority support of all of the men and women of the armed forces. This is not to say that there is still unanimity. I think there are obviously individuals who would still think that unification was not the right course. But they are in a very small minority, and the great majority believe that it's the organization of the future, that it's a reform which is not only militarily sound, which will save a lot of money, but which is the military organization of the next half century.
Paul Hellyer was destined to carry his fight for unification into 1967, and some are predicting his bill would never pass, but if it did, it would mark him as a man of strong character with real leadership ability, one in tune with the 20th century. 1966 also saw the annual provincial conference, where, inevitably, the provinces attempt to get more money from the federal government. In 1966, Quebec was represented by an exceptionally outstanding and astute prime minister. He was Daniel Johnson, who, following the first day of the conference, spoke with typical frankness.
I frankly have the impression, by following the proceedings today, that the BNA Act has been replaced by one man, the Federal Minister of Finance, Mr. Sharpe.
The other provincial premiers also felt that no was the only word Federal Minister Sharpe knew.
I think it was reported to the Prime Minister by Prime Minister of Canada, by one of the other Prime Ministers, that Mr. Sharpe only knew one word.
Yeah.
It's not true, but I... this is certainly I'm sure, the common view of all the provinces. It is to be expected, it is inevitable, and I am not ashamed of it.
The Liberal government's decision to delay Medicare created rumors of a feud between Finance Minister Sharpe and Health and Welfare Minister Alan McKechnie when, for budget reasons, it was decided to delay Medicare for 18 months. Explaining his position, the Finance Minister said,
"If I were the Minister of National Health and Welfare, I would be concerned too. I'm the Minister of Finance with a general responsibility for the economic stability of the country, and all ministers from time to time have to accept some delays or deferments in programs in order that we don't try to do too much all at once. And I certainly sympathize with the Minister of National Health and Welfare today, and I hope I am in the House of Commons when the Medicare bill goes through, and I hope I'm still around when it's in effect July the 1st, 1968.
Mr. McKechnie demonstrated, however, that he put party ahead of personal desires when, dispelling rumors of his reported feud with Mr. Sharpe, he said,
"Well, the resolution that was adopted by the conference was quite acceptable to me, because it did stipulate that the program come into effect not later than July 1st, 1968, but it did provide for sufficient flexibility in the intervening period that I thought was quite acceptable."
You don't feel that the party is letting down the country on commitments made during the election campaigns of 1963 and 65, promising Medicare for 67?
Well, the conference expressed its regret that this was necessary, but the principle of Medicare is not in doubt. I think it is even more deeply certain now than ever. The substance of the bill is quite intact, and I think these are important considerations.
1966 also saw a national railway strike in Canada, but by moving fast, the Liberal government quickly settled what could have been a major catastrophe. Transport Minister Jack Pickersgill, one of Canada's most respected political figures, reflects on the government's action.
The session of 1966 was devoted very largely to transport matters, particularly after the middle of the year, when the government felt it necessary, once a railway strike had taken place, and I emphasize that it was a lawful strike, felt it necessary to intervene and to ask Parliament to intervene to end the strike and to provide a means of settling the issues in dispute. Looking back now, I think we can say that whatever misgivings there may have been at the time, this seems to have been one of the wisest things done by the government in 1966. I say that not because it's desirable to intervene in these disputes between employers and employees, except in one circumstance, and that is when the interest of the public is so much more important than the interest of the parties that the public interest calls for intervention. Now, that happened in 1950, and the good effect of that lasted practically until 1966, and it happened again in 1966. And I think it will be a long time before we will have another railway strike in Canada.
In October 1966, Ottawa witnessed another Liberal convention, and Canada's youngest premier, 32-year-old Alex Campbell of Prince Edward Island, opened the conference with a vote of confidence in Lester Pearson.
That the Liberal Federation of Canada, in convention here assembled, express to the Right Honorable Lester B. Pearson its appreciation of his great devotion to the people of Canada, its affection for him, and its confidence in him as leader of the Liberal Party of Canada.
The Prime Minister humorously comments on reports that the Liberal right wing had crushed the Liberal left wing of the party.
Left wing was crunched. Well, this confirmed my hope that there are no wings in our party. Because I haven't been able to see a single person tonight, and I think I've seen everybody looking crunched. Pale, perhaps, from late hours, from much talk and more listening, but not a sign of crunching.
Commenting on his idea of what leadership means, the Prime Minister said,
on the other hand, a politician that can see only one side of every question and who digs himself in on that side can, if he is wrong, lead his party and his country to disaster. Remaining firm and immovable in a bucket of hardening cement is nothing to boast about. Political leadership is being steady, not stuck. So I hope you will pardon me for saying that I hope that my leadership will not be judged by the excitement generated by partisan conflict and controversy, but by a record of achievement, by what I have helped to do to increase the unity and the well-being of the people of this country.